I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people exploring how new technology is impacting our financial lives and warning us about hidden rules that can get communicators into trouble. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known by the acronym FIRE, recently distributed a warning to people visiting our national parks and monuments. It took me totally by surprise when I saw it because it cautioned that online posting of video shot in these popular venues might get you charged with a crime. Ronnie London is general counsel for FIRE, and he is with us now. So tell me, if I post a video shot in front of Mount Rushmore in which I say, God bless our beautiful country, or something like that, I can go to jail?
Well, let's make clear here that the permitting and fee regime at issue in the case that we were writing about applies to commercial filmmaking on federal lands. So as a threshold, you have to have the intent to commercialize your filming. So, but even if it's to earn a relatively small amount of money, if that's your intent in going into it, or even your hope in going into it, then arguably you are supposed to have a permit and pay the necessary fee, if any, before filming on federal lands. And this is what happened with the filmmaker in the case at issue, which is Price versus Garland. I should note that when this case started out in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, I was still in private practice with Davis Wright Tremaine, and I was co-counsel in the case for Mr. Price with lead counsel Bob Korn Revere. I have since moved on to FIRE, as you mentioned, so now I'm commenting as part of an advocacy group, no longer as the counsel for Mr. Price. But this is what happened to Mr. Price. He went out and he shot with a handful of friends a film in a national park. There were, you know, only parts of the film were shot there. He didn't know or get a permit or pay any fees to do so. The film ultimately was put together. It was called Crawford Road. It aired at a local establishment. It was a screening there. And it got a little bit of press coverage. And once the press coverage came out, the next thing you know, he is being visited by National Park Service rangers handing him a citation saying you are hereby potentially guilty of a misdemeanor for failing to get a permit to film in federal lands. And he had to go to court, and he was going to enter a plea before the judge stopped him and said, well, hold on a second now. There are some First Amendment issues here. You should probably get yourself some First Amendment counsel. And that's when Mr. Korn Revere stepped in. We challenged the citation. The government ultimately withdrew it, and there went the misdemeanor charge. But they didn't disavow the applicability of the fee and permit regime, and therefore there was a federal lawsuit brought to challenge the constitutionality of that. Bringing it back to your example, arguably, if you were going to go to a national park and you brought your cell phone and you were planning on posting something on a website or social media platform from which you derive revenues or you're otherwise paid, arguably that's commercial filming in a national park, and you need to check the fee and permit regime and figure out whether you need a permit and what fees you might have to pay, if any. If you don't, you can get yourself a citation and some misdemeanor charge. And as the dissent points out, that can mean up to 6 months in prison.
So this is a longstanding practice, but it seems like, you know, this is public land. This is maintained through our taxes. It isn't like you're going into somebody's private home or going into somebody else's company headquarters. Somehow it doesn't seem right.
Do you want me to argue with that? Because I think you stated it quite well. The fact of the matter is, this is a relatively long-standing statute. I mean, it's been around for a little while. I mean, now that the case has wound its way through the courts, it's been a number of years that it's been on the books. And once the statute was adopted, the National Park Service and similar agencies responsible for federal lands had to issue regulations to implement the statute. But You're right. These are federal lands. These are, you know, the grounds maintained for the public to visit and to, you know, communicate with each other and do as they will. And so what the real issue here is that this statute in particular says that the agencies responsible for these lands have to establish a reasonable fee for commercial filming activities, and it has to return a fair return to the United States based on, you know, a handful of criteria like size of the crew, number of days, the type of equipment. And it's very clear that these costs shall be collected completely separately from any administrative or personnel costs that the agencies might incur for overseeing the activity, to make sure that there are no damage to sensitive areas or there's no competing uses scheduled for the same time or anything like that. Those fees are collected completely separately. This is about allegedly a fair return for commercial filming activities. In other words, the government wants a piece of the action.
Is there a religious exemption? I mean, I could see a church holding, say, an Easter sunrise service in a national park and then selling the video of that. Does the religious identity shield them in any way?
You could argue that that is perhaps not commercial because it's purely religious and it's a nonprofit and it's therefore not turning a commercial revenue. But that being said, there is an exception, oddly enough, that you should ask. There's a special exception for news gathering activities. And so even though news gathering activities might impose the same burdens on federal lands that a commercial film crew might pose, and by the way, because some news gathering activities might well be for a for-profit purpose, nonetheless, those are exempted from the statute. And that includes documentaries, but then only documentaries that cover things like current events that are matters of current public interest. If your documentary doesn't cover that, you fall back into the commercial filmmaking category if you intend to make any money from that. But there isn't a per se religious exception. There is perhaps an argument, depending on the nature or the organization and the endeavor in which they're engaged, whether it's commercial in the first instance, but you do raise a fair point.
Well, I can see if you're a professional, you're going to know the rules and you're going to deal with the appropriate people within the governing agency. But how can the ordinary tourist or the ordinary small-time video producer or podcaster avoid getting into trouble?
That's exactly the point. I mean, that's how Mr. Price found himself in this situation. Now, obviously, there's the, you know, longstanding adage that ignorance of the law is no excuse. But at the same time, why would somebody with a buddy who's going to hold a boom mic and another buddy who's got the tripod and another buddy who's going to read a script while you film, why would they think, oh, wait a minute, do I need a permit and to pay the government money to be out here recording this video or filming this film? I mean, everyone's digital now, right? So I don't know if there's a film per se, but do I need money? Do I need to approach the government, go to the appropriate agency? You're right. I don't think most people are aware that this is a requirement. And you can find yourself visited by NPS agents at your door handing you a citation, coming as quite a surprise.
Well, if this should happen, what should people do? Can they contact FIRE?
They could. Absolutely. FIRE, as of June of this year, we have expanded our mission. We used to be the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Our focus was predominantly individual rights in higher education. As of June of this year, however, we've expanded our focus. And so we cover all First Amendment issues all over, not just on campus anymore. We do have a page at our website. It's, you know, the fire.org/alarm. It's our submit a case page. If you were to find yourself with such a citation, you could absolutely contact FIRE. Although, with the court's decision from last week, now it's an open question about what can be done, right? Because the trial court in this case, we made a very, what I thought at the time, and I still believe, was a very strong case that this regime is unconstitutional. The trial court agreed, and it enjoined it. The decision from last week reverses that decision and puts the entire regime back in place and declares it constitutional on, in my opinion, what are some constitutionally suspect grounds. I don't think they're applying First Amendment doctrine properly. But nonetheless, the regime is back in place. So you can come to FIRE. You can come to a First Amendment attorney, like the firm that I used to work at, and, you know, we can, you know, see what we can do to help you. But now we've got this federal appeals court ruling that's sitting out there saying that this is all okay. So there's the question about how to get that revisited.
Ronnie London, General Counsel for FHIR, thanks a lot for taking time to talk about this. This is something that people really should be aware of. You could get yourself into all kinds of hot water quite easily, I should think.
Yeah, you're right.
For years, we've heard that our economy is moving beyond traditional currency. I can recall reading an article in Business Week back in the early 1970s. That piece predicted that we'll someday be living in what they called a checkless, cashless society. Well, we've certainly been moving in that direction, becoming more and more dependent on credit cards. But in the last decade or so, we've been hearing about something called cryptocurrency. Well, that is units of value that exist entirely in the online world. Matt Pinto is a Catholic author and entrepreneur who has studied this new way of handling wealth, and he sees implications for Catholic businesses, as well as for churches, and even many aspects of our lives as citizens, consumers, and believers. Matt, thanks for being with us. Please give us a little background on this crypto phenomenon. What exactly is cryptocurrency?
Yes. First of all, Bill, it's good to be with you. And so the question is actually a little bit of a moving target. When people hear cryptocurrency, they think, you know, literally what the words say, cryptology or cryptographic currencies. But the word, Bill, crypto, is really a catch-all phrase for something much bigger. It's really a catch-all phrase, like the internet is a catch-all phrase for a whole variety of things. So it really is closely tied to something called blockchain, and crypto and blockchain, like a mom and a dad, come together and spawn children such as Web 3.0, non-fungible tokens called NFTs, something called the metaverse. And as Catholics, we naturally should have both a curiosity, which is good, but also a prudence, because that's the mother of all virtues, that we should be prudent. So we should look at these things and try and unpack whether they are a net gain or a net loss. And that's the purpose of a particular conference that I am putting on with about 30 presenters in November.
Yeah, that should be an interesting occasion, and maybe some of these questions can be answered more fully, but we're kind of overwhelmed with terms, blockchain technology being only one of them, but I've heard about mining Bitcoin and all of that. How do these things work?
There were attempts at digital value, digital exchanges of commerce over the past 30 and 40 years, but due to this blockchain technology, which really is a very big ledger that becomes sort of immutable, hard to penetrate, it facilitated a peer-to-peer ability of exchanging value that became known as Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is again, a digital currency. But quite frankly, Bill, you know, the money that you and I hear about the Federal Reserve printing, well, they're not printing at all. These are electronic transfers from bank to bank. So we're already living in this world.
Sure.
But Bitcoin mining in particular is, not that you focused too much on this, but it's really the method by which this network, this peer-to-peer financial network known as Bitcoin, is upheld. It's actually the most powerful computer network in the world. And Bill, something very interesting. It's a distributed network, and what that means is that it's not housed in any one location, which means not only does that prevent a single point of failure, but it also actually gives us protections because, as you know, with the truckers up in Canada, if a particular authority was not happy that maybe you sent a donation to those truckers, it shut that donation off. In a distributed network, that can't be shut off because there is no place that you can call to say shut down that transaction because it's a distributed network that is literally housed on tens and tens of thousands of computers who do not know each other. So it really provides a very unique opportunity, this decentralization, to avoid our freedoms getting restricted. Now, that's not a guarantee at this point, but that's one of the promises of cryptocurrency in general, but Bitcoin in particular.
Right. That has been one of the key points that I have heard made in defense of this whole movement, is that it becomes very diffuse and democratized. It enhances our freedom. But on the other hand, I've also heard that the federal government is looking at ways of bringing this technology under control of some sort of central global administration. Would that impede our freedom?
Well, remember, we're actually talking about two different types of digital currency. A government-controlled one would be called, they're calling it a central bank digital currency, a CBDC, to which anyone really should be nervous from the word go in that regard. For example, if they don't want you eating chocolate cake from Starbucks, you know, after 12 o'clock at midnight, you know, well, then that could be shut off. I mean, it really is the ultimate danger to freedom. But when you speak about a decentralized currency versus a centralized one under an authority such as government, then it potentially offers the opposite, meaning it would enable us to avoid that type of scrutiny. And again, it's all a little dangerous. It's all a little scary because we all know, you know, either a little bit or, you know, much about something, but we don't know it all. But these things are heading in that direction anyway, which is why we Catholics and people of goodwill need to have a voice at the table, which is in part why we're doing this conference.
I understand that at least one archdiocese is already accepting donations and offerings in the form of cryptocurrency. Do you expect that to spread throughout the church?
I do, although I really anticipate it being pretty much just Bitcoin, very likely, and maybe one or two of the other prominent ones. But sure, I mean, I was at a parish in New York, a historic parish, about a month ago, and I was giving a talk, and I wanted to have a little reflective time before the talk, so I went into the church, and I sat in the pew, and in front of me, as it was in front of all the pews, because you could plainly see, was a Venmo code. This was during COVID. This was probably a result of COVID. They didn't want to hand out envelopes and collect envelopes. So we're already doing this type of thing. But it was the Archdiocese of Washington. It was about a month and a half or so ago. So sure, I think it's going to pick up, just like all technologies seem to eventually get picked up by the church. I mean, if you and I had this conversation in 1994 or 1995 about the internet, we would have been both curious and cautious, and correctly so. But within 5 to 8 years, we would have seen, well, oh my goodness, all the parishes now have a website, and all of them are using email, or almost all of them.
What are the implications for us as individual believers? I can see where it would certainly give us a convenient way of supporting our parishes or whatever charities we might wish to participate in. Is there a moral side of this?
I think so. First, again, let me clarify. When we speak about crypto, we're talking about an array of things. For example, the next evolution of the internet is being aggressively discussed right now, and quite frankly, it's already rolling out, and they're calling that Web 3.0, and that's a decentralized web. Just like you and I were discussing decentralized commerce, a decentralized web is an internet where the powers that be at Facebook and Twitter can't stifle your free speech because it's a distributed internet platform. It's kind of like a Twitter without the board over top of Twitter. It's kind of like a Twitter that's distributed between, you know, tens of thousands of computers holding up the network. So the moral implication or the faith implication in that regard, again, one of the manifestations of this crypto wider definition, is that we might be able to have platforms where we know Catholicism and our voice and the gospel would have a greater chance of not being shackled. But Bill, I would contend that we Christians, again, I used the word prudence earlier. It's the mother, again, of all virtues. It should guide all of our discernments in the carrying out of the other virtues. But another thing as Christians is that we are called to be bold. We are called to go out into the deep and cast our nets. We are called, like the parable of the talents, to not bury the one talent out of fear of losing it, but to look to multiply with the Lord's grace, multiply his goodness in the world. And that requires risk. I think that we have become immobilized often as a church. We're so afraid of either a lawsuit or so afraid of making a mistake that we really neuter ourselves. So my message to those who are listening is that the moral implications are that we're called to be lights in the world. Being lights in the world requires that we go into realms of darkness at times, and that can be scary. But with God's grace and, again, natural gifts given to us through the virtues, I believe most of the time we will make the right choice, and most of the time we will bear fruit. But it requires risk.
There's another trend that seems to be gaining some momentum right now, and that is development of what's being called an alternative Christian culture. Catholic or Christian entrepreneurs setting up their own businesses that are kind of away from the mainstream, not dependent on large service providers. Or it seems to me that this whole crypto movement dovetails with that pretty readily.
Yes, and I would be a supporter of those initiatives in probably 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 instances. I would support that from the word go. I do think that entities have become so big and so powerful that they're potentially positively dangerous to we Christians. We have enough evidence about that just by reading the headlines of the past few years.
Sure.
So, sure. I mean, I think there have been some people who have looked at certain aspects of this decentralized blockchain world in which we now live and have wondered whether it's been given to us for times such as these. I'm not sure I go to that level of saying that this is absolutely of God. It's still a question, but it's a question we need to look into, which is what we're hoping to do. So, yeah, I think it's very prudent and very possible that these technologies could precisely dovetail with the establishment of other rails on which either information or media or commerce flow.
Well, tell us about this conference that you've got in the offing. It's going to be in November in the Valley Forge area. What's it all about?
It is. Yeah, it's called the Catholic Crypto Conference. You can get there at CatholicCryptoConference.com. And we have, I think we're approaching maybe 30 speakers, about 42 seminars over 2 days. It will be recorded. It will be live streamed. We will be announcing that in the next few days on the website, how someone can do that. And then we're going to have a few hundred people in person. It's going to be an extraordinary event. I actually think, Bill, that in our history, in our recent history as a church, that we were a little bit behind in technology when it came to the internet. I think we were probably 8 to 10 years behind. Doing the conference this early in the discussion of the advent of these new technologies, we should have as a source of pride as Catholics that we're doing it this early in the game. So we're going to have a couple hundred people in person. We're probably going to have many more live stream, and it's going to be a special event. We got some great Catholic philosophers, theologians, and pastoral ministers coming alongside technologists, crypto experts, and finance experts. It's really going to be an interesting mash of ideas and world.
Well, you're the guy who is certainly well-positioned to take the lead in this. Your background is so varied. You founded Ascension Press. You've been involved in the development of Envoy Magazine and Catholic Exchange. So your experience in the online world certainly prepares you to do this. How can people find out more about this conference?
The words Catholic Crypto Conference, and crypto is CRYPTO. You can just Google. We should come up either number one or number two in the search engine, or just type it into the URL, the web address, CatholicCryptoConference.com.
Matt Pinto of the Catholic Crypto Conference, thank you very much for being with us. This should be a fascinating event. I look forward to what may come out of it. Will you be making the material available after the event?
We will. In fact, good triggering of a reminder. We will be capturing the videos and releasing them. But we are going to issue, Bill, 5 different white papers for free, just distributing to the church. and our bishops as a gift. We're going to have special sessions towards the end of the conference where the people, the attendees at the conference, break off and strategize on how each of these technologies could be used for the church for the express purpose of releasing some free white papers authored by everyone. We then will then get out and distribute to the church so the church can, God willing, run with some of these ideas or put up good defenses in situations where we see some possible negative effects.
Matt Pinto, thanks a lot. I enjoyed speaking with you, and I look forward to seeing what comes of this crypto conference.
Thank you, Bill.
If you've been listening to these shows online but would like to hear them on the radio, tell your local Catholic station. Free Expression with Bill Castle is available for broadcast free of charge. Ask your Catholic station to contact us by email, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. That's BILLKASSEL, all one word, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. And don't forget to support your local station. In this time of censorship and so-called cancel culture, Catholic radio is becoming increasingly important as an alternative media source. Our programming is based on the Word of God and the teaching of His Church, and we bring you the factual, truthful information you aren't getting from the mainstream media. Support Catholic radio. Your generosity keeps Catholic outlets on the air, and donations to broadcast ministries can be tax-deductible. Urge your friends and relatives to tune in as well. And please, let me know what you think about these shows. Tell me what books you're reading, what media you follow, what sort of music communicates with your soul. I'd love your suggestions on topics we might explore that touch the lives of Catholics today, important ideas we might discuss, interesting people we might speak with. Email me with your thoughts, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. And while you're at it, check out my website, billcastle.com, where you'll find information on my novel about the family of Jesus. It's titled My Brother's Keeper, and it won the Catholic Arts and Letters Award for Best Adult Fiction. That's billcastle.com. Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.